podcast of Toller Dole Fisher.
Hello and welcome. This is Woman Alive with me, Toller Dole Fisher. This is the podcast for Christian women where I'm chatting with real women about real life and real faith.
If we don't talk about it at all, we give a message as there is something wrong with this and there is something intrinsically shameful about this because it's not being spoken about.
You know, not to make it too judgmental or condemning, so that if children do, when they're teenagers, they do certain things, they can be forgiven.
The Woman Alive podcast, in association with Mercy Ships. Available now on premier.plus. Welcome back to another episode of the Woman Alive podcast with me, Toller Dole Fisher. I'm a millennial, so I learned about sex the old-fashioned way, the school playground. But in these days, sex education and sex itself is just a click away, no matter how old you are. So the conversation we're having today is, do we need to start having more grown-up conversations with children and teenagers about sex? And if so, where do we start? So to discuss this with me today, I have first up friend of the podcast, Kate Orson. Kate, you are a freelance writer and have written for the Daily Mail, Telegraph and the Metro, as well as most importantly, Woman Alive. You are the author of a book called Tears Heal, How to Listen to Our Children. Welcome, Kate. And Emma Waring. Emma, you are a nurse, a psychosexual therapist and author of the book Seasons of Sex and Intimacy, A Practical Guide to Sex Within Marriage. Welcome, Kate, and welcome, Emma. Did I get your bios right? Always conscious of this.
You did.
Yay! Point for me that I've just given to myself. All right, before we have the conversation today, I want to do the quick Bible quiz that we always do at the beginning of the podcast. And today's question is, according to the Bible, why does God give us boundaries about sex or around sex? So why does God give us boundaries around sex? And the multiple choice answers are, or options are, A, to protect us from temptation, B, to protect us and give us an abundant life, or C, to help us have stable families. So according to the Bible, why does God give us boundaries about sex? The answers again are, or the options again are, to protect us from temptation, A, B, to protect us and give us an abundant life, or C, to help us have stable families. Kate, you're top of my screen. What do you think the answer is?
It seems like a bit of a trick question because I feel like it should be all of them.
I did think that when I read this, but if I was to push you on one of those, what would you choose?
That's tricky. A.
Which was to protect us from temptation.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And what about you, Emma?
I'm in agreement with Kate. I think there's, you know, it could be actually all of them, but if pushed, I'm going to say B.
Okay, and B is to protect us and give us an abundant life. And I honestly, I think you're right. I think it could be a mixture of slash all of those things. But the answer that I have in front of me is B, which is to protect us and give us an abundant life. So just based on these two passages in the Bible, 1 Corinthians 10:13, it says, no temptation has overtaken you except what is common to mankind, and God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. And in John 10:10, which is one of my favorite verses in the whole of the Bible, it says, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. So according to those two passages, God gives us boundaries in sex and other activities in order that we might have a full life with him. So the conversation we're having today, Kate, you wrote an article for us at womanalive.co.uk actually at the end of last year, and it was entitled What Little House on the Prairie Taught Me About a Godly Attitude to Sex and Marriage. So if anyone hasn't read that, can you just read a little bit of that article?
Yeah, sure. So, our current world is getting darker and darker as adolescents are accessing pornography at younger and younger ages and being told things like polyamory are liberating. Raising a teen in these times seems almost impossible, but Laura Ingalls gives me a model of what true joy and contentment can look like. She still takes joy in buying a pretty dress and bonnet, but her excitement is gained from riding fast in a horse and carriage rather than sex and drugs. I still feel like a bit of a hypocrite when talking about sex and marriage, but through God's grace and the Little House on the Prairie series, I'm starting to escape my own past history.
Thanks, Kate. Okay, so would you both agree that talking about sex has been taboo amongst Christians, first of all?
Yes.
And Kate, in your experience, I know you didn't grow up in the...
Yeah, so yeah, it is a bit different for me because I didn't grow up in the church, but I can imagine that it is, as it is in society in general, it can be taboo to talk openly about it.
And just as to both of you, do you feel like in the church that's been the right response, that kind of attempt to kind of curb maybe some of the enthusiasm or excitement around sex? Has that been the right response to kind of make it a taboo subject?
Well, my sense is no. I think that there's been limited discussion around sex has left people with more questions, really, and actually a lot of shame, particularly women. I don't think the church has done the subject justice. But actually, I don't think we haven't spoken very well about this subject outside of the church as well. Sex is often trivialised or it's joked about, but we haven't, as a society, been very comfortable talking about sexual issues and particularly sexual problems, which in my line of work, you know, I see regularly in my clinic, but sexual problems are very, very common for many people, but we don't talk about it because, again, there's a sense of shame and people don't talk about it with their friends. They may allude to things, but they actually, when you ask people whether they talk openly with their friends about, or even their partner, actually, and I see this part in my work, you know, a couple may be experiencing sexual problems and they find it really difficult to find the language to talk to the person that, you know, they're closest to in the world about what's going on for them, what's going on for them within their body, what they're experiencing. So I think generally, I think it's changing, but I think generally we have a society had difficulty talking about sex and also about things like periods and menopause and childbirth and, you know, really kind of normal, natural parts of life. We've struggled with, and we've wanted to sanitize things.
Absolutely.
I was interested the other day when I saw an advertisement for a sanitary towel, and I noticed this is the first time that the blood has been shown in red.
I was going to mention that, actually. I think it's quite a new thing.
It's a new thing. It's usually shown in blue.
Yeah, but which is just the most bizarre thing, because no one's bleeding. We're not Smurfs. No one's bleeding blue. But it is interesting, that idea of sanitization. And I do think it's a fair point that the world hasn't got sex education right either, not just the church. So, Kate, I know you, in your writing for Woman Alive, you talk about how you became a Christian in 2021, I think it was. From a perspective of not growing up in church and then having children, so you're kind of bringing them up in the way of faith, do you think it's the church's responsibility, or do you think the church has a responsibility to educate its members about sex, or should it come from somewhere else? Should it be parents? Should it where, who is responsible for that?
Yeah, good question. I think in an ideal world, it would be amazing if there were good conversations about it in the church, but I think as parents, we have to take responsibility for it, because if we don't, the children might not get any education about it and open conversation. So I personally feel as a parent that it's completely my responsibility to take it on. And also, just personally, my church is really small. There's only the pastor's children in the church and my daughter that goes occasionally. So I can't really expect like a youth group to have these kind of conversations. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I think it's quite difficult, because we're saying that we believe there's a creator that created this gift of sex. Some of that can feel like, well, that should be taught from the pulpit. But actually, there are some nuances around sexual education and conversations around sex that maybe only a parent can really, you know for their own child. And actually, maybe that it's good to have the conversations from the front. But I would also say and kind of argue, like you've said, Kate, that parents have a responsibility as well, so that we're not passing on the lack of knowledge that some of us might have had when we were younger, and also for women around periods, menopause, all the other things that that happen quite naturally in many of our bodies. Emma, in your experience, in your work, what are the most common questions that teenagers have about sex?
Well, I don't work with teenagers. I only work with adults, and I work with lots of couples. So I don't specifically work with teenagers. What I would say, though, in relation to my work, is that when I meet with an individual or a couple and they're experiencing sexual difficulties, in most cases, I will take quite an extensive history from them, because I'm not just thinking about how their genitals are working or not working. I think about the person as a whole. And so I will ask in-depth questions about, what sort of family did you grow up in? Tell me a little bit about your parents or your main caregivers. Did you have siblings? And then I will ask about the culture of that family. So, were your parents comfortable with you seeing them naked? Were your parents affectionate with each other, or were they quite reserved? Did you see them being affectionate and kissing and cuddling? Where did you learn about how babies were made? Who talked to you about sex? And I think what's really, really interesting is that, and it may be a generational thing that I'm working with, often clients of a certain age, and this could be different if I fast forwarded 20 years, the answers I get from clients could be very different. But certainly with people that I'm seeing in their 30s and 40s, 50s, for lots of people, they will say that their parents didn't ever have a conversation with them about sex, that was left to the school, to a biology class, simply about how a baby is made. So there was nothing in terms of context about relationships. And I'd be working with people from all faiths and of no faith. So I work in a secular clinic, so I get a really broad span of people that I'm seeing and working with. But it's interesting that parents typically, it's unusual for me to meet a patient where a parent or parents have been comfortable talking about sex. And the thing that I think is really interesting as well is what the child growing up picks up from what is not being said. So we don't even have to talk negatively about the subject of sex. If we don't talk about it at all, we give a message. Absence of it, yeah. And that's often picked up as, there is something wrong with this, and there is something intrinsically shameful about this because it's not being spoken about. I mean, and patients will say things, you know, like, oh, I've got a memory of walking into the bathroom and getting shouted at by my mum and told to close the door. So again, sort of feelings around nudity being wrong, there being something shameful. About being naked. Yeah. So I think we often have to think about the messages that we give by not talking about something, just as much as about the messages we give in the way we do discuss something.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a good point there you've made, and you made up earlier about shame and sometimes the connotations we have around sex as a leads to shame. And this conversation is about sex advice for teenagers, but actually, given what we're talking about in terms of some of the sexual education being suppressed for Christians, there are many, many, and we know this from the emails that we get, adults who have no idea about sex and who weren't given any education and were just told to kind of get married and get on with it. So it's actually about sex education throughout the whole church, because we all need to have an education that comes from the right place, but also we might not have had it in our formative years. So that's what I'm realising a lot in the work that I do with Women Alive. And just back to you, Kate. So in Genesis 2, 24, 25, it says, that's why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked and they felt no shame. And Emma, you also were talking about how sex education sometimes is conveyed to students or young people or whoever in a very biological sense and not with anything else that is other than the kind of physical aspect of how this works. And Kate, because you didn't grow up in a Christian household, I don't know what that experience was for you in terms of such education, but did you find that your education on that was more biological, or did it come with there is more to this than just a physical uniting?
It was a long time ago. I had my sex education at school. It was just biological, as far as I remember. I think now, judging from what my daughter's doing at school, that it's more like they start with relationships, and then as the children get older, then yeah, they introduce the biological stuff as well.
Okay, and do you think that in something you read out earlier, as you said, you still feel like a bit of a hypocrite when talking about sex and marriage? And do you feel as though if you'd had that relationship relevant education when it came to sex when you were younger, that you would feel differently about that, or you would have approached it differently? Would that have changed how you approached it?
No, I think for me it was just the Christian part of it was missing. So I didn't grow up with this idea that you wait for marriage or anything like that. So then I think for me it's yeah, it's something to work towards to talk about with my daughter, the Christian point of view of waiting for marriage, because obviously I didn't do that, but I can see the value of doing that with hindsight and looking back.
So when it comes to giving advice and talking to teenagers, or like I've said, I just said just now, actually talking to anyone about sex and sex education, where do we start? Because Emmy, you said earlier that you haven't met, correct me if I'm wrong, you haven't actually met any patients or parents who find it easy to talk about sex. So how do we have that conversation? Where do we start with it?
Well, I would say there were a few people that I've met over, I mean, I've worked in this field for over 20 years now, but it's very, very exceptional for me to meet somebody who's had really good input. So, my advice is that we need to start talking about this from a very, very young age. And it's usually the age where children usually start to ask where babies come from is around 3.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because we start taking them out and about, and we go to things like farms with little baby animals. So it's really, it makes a lot of sense that a little child would think, actually, that's a baby chick. I was a baby. They might see a baby. Where's that come from? And so I think the key thing is that we have to be age appropriate. So to begin with, a child will ask about where a baby comes from. So you can talk about an egg and the seed. And the challenge here, and I think it's really important for us to do this, but I know amongst my own peer group, some of my friends have said, oh, that's really difficult. A child will say, but how does the egg and the seed get together? And this is where I think we just need to be really factual, and we need to talk about a penis and a vagina, and we can give them other names. We might give them other names within the house. So we might use the correct anatomical name, penis, and then we might say, so you're Willy, which is a kind of a gentler term that we might use with a little boy. And we talk about actually what happens during sex. And, so some people that I've worked with or friends have said, oh, I'm okay about the kind of egg and the seed, but it gets really tricky when they say, well, how do they get together? And I think we've just got to move past our own embarrassment, and we just need to be honest and say, this is how it works. And the reason I think that's really key is that I think that with sex education, we need to layer it and we need to be age appropriate. But it's really great if we've built a foundation that we, as the child gets older, we can then integrate other things. So I remember reading an article in the newspaper that I was fairly shocked by. And it was by a writer saying that we needed to start talking to our children about pornography. And the age that we needed to start discussing this was around sort of 9. And I remember being quite shocked by this, but then reading on and realizing that the reason that this was being advocated was because there are children with smartphones who are 9.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense. And so I took this on board and thought about it. And actually, it was made so much easier because I had had conversations with my kids when they were 3. And those conversations had carried on. So it wasn't like I was having to hit the ground running at 9, talking about pornography when I hadn't even had a conversation about how a baby is made. And I was able to do that in the context of talking about a relationship and love and creating a baby and all those kind of things. So layering, I think, is absolutely key. And obviously that continues as your child gets into teenage years. But if you've got solid foundations that you've built with them, it feels less daunting to you as a parent and to broach some of the more trickier conversations that can come into play as they get older and they start to hear things from friends or they start to see stuff or exposed to stuff that may not be ideal. You've already got a solid foundation which you can go back to talk about.
And then there's that openness that it allows between the parent and the child, that they
absolutely
can trust you and go to you.
Yeah, absolutely. You've already built that.
Yeah. And Kate, you said earlier that you weren't obviously given that the Christian perspective of sex education when you were growing up. What would that look like, or what could that have looked like in terms of kind of relationships and a healthy education? What perspective would that have given you when you were younger? I think I asked something similar earlier, but I just want to know, like, for a parent now who's a Christian and wants and says, I really want my child to have a Christ-centered understanding of sex, what would that look like or sound like?
I think it's explaining like what God says about sex in the Bible and why it should be in marriage and why that's important, but not to do it in a. I've heard a lot of about purity culture. I think that was quite popular in the US, and that some people got really traumatized by purity culture and this idea that if they've done something that then they're impure and things like that. So I think it's got to be shared in a way like this is what God says, but you know, not to make it too judgmental or condemning, so that if children do, when they're teenagers, they do certain things, that they feel that they could maybe talk to us about it, or also that they can be forgiven and that they're not impure for the rest of their lives because of something that they've done.
Can I just add a point in? I think you've made a really good point, Kate. And there's a really interesting book that I've been reading. I've got it here, actually, called Pure. And it's written by Linda K. Klein. And it's her experience of growing up in the purity culture and the damage that it did. And she said that she makes two interesting points. And she goes back and interviews her church friends around the time of the purity culture and the impact that it had on their lives, which was actually very negative for many women. Was there was a real double standard in the purity culture between men and women. So a real sense that it was a woman's place or a young girl's place to hold the boundary. And there was a real sort of double standard around. I mean, you can see it in terms of the woman walks down the aisle in white and sign of her purity. The man, no questions are asked. And can I just read a short passage from the book, which I think really
sums
up? So it says, the cornerstone of the purity myth is the expectation that girls and women in particular will be utterly and absolutely non-sexual until the day they marry a man, at which point they will naturally and easily become his sexual satisfier. Ensuring the couple will have children and never divorce, one man, one woman in marriage forever. For this formula to work, my girlfriends and I knew we had to follow a slew of rules. Unfortunately, none of us knew what they were. Sex was such a shameful topic that we never got straight talk on what we were and were not allowed to do. It was assumed that if no one ever talked to us about sex, it would just sort of go away until we needed it. So our sex talks were all generic metaphors and warnings about what would happen to us if we crossed a line, which was defined differently by so many people that we were left guessing all the same. Meanwhile, we knew we would be shamed if we asked sexual questions, shamed if we discussed sexual decisions, shamed if we shared our confusing sexual feelings and thoughts, and shamed worst of all if we admitted that we had done anything sexual. So each of us guessed at what the rules might be, hoped we were right, and didn't tell anyone about our sex lives just in case we weren't.
Wow. Gosh, that's really That's really interesting, and also so true about the purity culture. I mean, I didn't grow up in the US, I grew up in the UK, but I read like Judy Blume growing up, and there was a lot of references to American literature that I had, and so I watched American TV when I was allowed to watch TV, but that's a whole other story. But I think definitely young boys and young girls did get a different education from the church about sex. And so kind of in wrapping this conversation up, because there's a lot of stuff to ponder on with this topic. From what I remember at school, sex education I went to a girls' school, but we had our own sex education classes, and then we went to Harrow School, which was our brother school, to have more social education classes. Is it important to educate boys and girls separately about sex and then together, or do we need to have some kind of middle ground? I mean, that's in church and in the school, because if we're teaching girls one thing and teaching boys another thing, there's going to be a bit of mismatch when we come together.
I have a bit of a bee in my bonnet that we should be collectively discussing these issues, not separating them out. I think it's really, really important that girls learn about boys. I think it's really important that boys learn about girls. And so personally, I'm not a big fan of separating. I think it's really important that girls and boys are given the same messages, and there isn't a sort of double standard there.
And I would agree, and I don't know if that happens now. But what would you say, Kate, to that? To the idea that in church and in the classroom, maybe sex education should be done, with everybody involved.
Yeah, I think it should. I've never really given it much thought, but it makes sense that everyone's having the same conversation, and also that idea that it's not hidden. There's nothing shameful about what girls are learning about or what boys are learning about. So just to have it all out in the open.
All right, thank you both. Emma, you mentioned at the beginning, before we started talking officially on the podcast, that you had some your teenagers had some advice that they wanted to share, or they advised you to share. So what does that look like?
So I was having a discussion around the dinner table some weeks ago when I was asked to be involved in the podcast, and they were very encouraging of me doing so, which for teenagers, that's a kind of a hidden compliment. I took that as a compliment. You don't get a lot of teenagers, but I thought that was a really positive thing. So I said, okay, give me some feedback. So they said, build up bit by bit, the which goes back to talking about, talk about where babies come from, when children are really young, when they're inquisitive. And just to make a point here, children don't actually have shame. They don't have intrinsic shame. It's adults that overlay shame to children. So that's why children are happy to walk around with no clothes on. They're free. They're
They,
not
I feel
born with,
like toddlers love being naked.
yeah, they do. They're not born with shame. They have no awareness about genitals being dirty or shameful. They just love being free, and it's absolutely appropriate as adults that we talk to them about when to be naked and when not to. But they don't intrinsically have shame. So build up bit by bit. But remember, if you're having a conversation with a 3-year-old, then they're not going to feel shame or embarrassment. I remember having an explicit conversation with one of my children when they were 3 about how babies were made, and they said, "Oh, that's so funny. What are you having for tea?" No issue at all. No issue at all. So it's the embarrassment is felt in the adult. It's not felt in the child, and it's really important to remember that. Their advice was treat the child with maturity. So make it age appropriate, but treat them with maturity. Go to them, do not wait for them to come to you.
Oh, that's the opposite of what I hear in a lot of
Take the
parenting.
responsibility, take
Ah.
responsibility. But remember, if you've started at 3, it's much easier. It's a conversation that you've always been having. Interesting, this is what they said. They said they've always known, we've never had the talk. They've always known, as long as they can remember, they've known about how babies were made, they've known about relationships and sex being a precious thing. Interestingly, I was pleased about this. They said really focus on the value of relationships. So a bit as you were saying, Kate, that I think schools are getting better at looking at a wider context for talking about sex, relationships, consent, all those kind of things. The importance of emotional connection, and let them ask questions.
Okay, where can people find out more about the work that you both do? I'll start with you, Kate. Where can people find you? And also, can you share quickly about some of what your book is about?
So my book, Tears Heal, How to Listen to Our Children, is a parenting book that I wrote before I became a Christian. So there's some things that I wouldn't have put in the book if I wrote it now, but it's still good parenting advice about listening to children. And that can set the foundation for having these kind of conversations where children feel safe and not being judged if they bring up certain subjects. And you can find me on Substack at www.kateorsonwrites.substack.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And Emma, where can people find out more about you and your work?
So they can go to my website, which is emmawaring.com. And you can get my book from, I think I should say, all good bookstores. Specialist book that can be ordered in. So the book has a focus for Christian couples, but actually one of the things that I've enjoyed about feedback is that people without a faith have read it and said how helpful they found it. And I wouldn't want the faith aspect to put anyone off, because my goal for writing this book was to talk about the challenges of keeping sex alive in a committed relationship. And some of the important key things to think about. And the second half of the book is how to manage sexual problems, which are really common. So erection problems, sexual pain, ejaculatory issues, unconsummated marriage. These things are really common. I see them every day in my work, but we don't talk about them. And there are so many things that couples can do for themselves. They don't necessarily need to see a sex therapist.
Great, thank you so much, both of you. All of the articles we discuss on the podcast are published at womanalive.co.uk. And you can get 50% off a full year subscription to Woman Alive magazine by heading to womanalive.co.uk/podcast.
Before we begin, please note that the conversations in this podcast are authentic and honest, which may occasionally include topics or thoughts that are more suitable for adult listeners. We advise discretion if young children are nearby.
Right, we've spoken so much in this main conversation. We haven't got long to talk about the read dilemma that we do at the end. However, I'm going to make it a brief one and ask if you can just both say one point for this reader based on their dilemma. And here is what came in as part of the Great Expectations series. I think I'm asexual and just want to know if this is the way God made me or if there's something wrong with me. And there is a bit more information that has been given online, but in brief, this is a 32-year-old woman who hasn't had sex and is waiting for marriage, but also hasn't got a desire for marriage. So the main question is, how do you know if you're asexual? Just one point from each of you would be great. I'll start with Emma, because this is feel like an area that you might have expertise in. What do you think?
Asexuality is quite rare. So it is literally the absence of any desire, any sexual thoughts, any sexual fantasies, any sexual feelings. I would be interested, if I was talking to this woman, to explore her upbringing and views around sex, and you know, whether there are issues relating to shame, exploring her body, feeling comfortable in her body, thinking about desire and pleasure. She may not be able to give herself permission to have sexual thoughts or fantasies, because it may be that they are so intrinsically linked with this idea of only having these feelings, a little bit like the paragraph in the book, only becoming sexual when you're married. Mm-hmm. Actually, we need to be comfortable with our bodies, we need to understand our sexuality, we need to understand how our bodies respond, we need to be alive sexually. And so my question to her would be, are there reasons why that's been challenging for you? And I suspect there may be some answers there, rather than just saying that I'm asexual and that part isn't accessible to me. It's not there. I would suggest it is, but it's maybe buried.
Thanks, Emma. And Kate, if there is someone in your, maybe a friend or a colleague, or not, maybe not colleague, a friend or someone in church that had this query and they asked you, what one point would you respond with?
Yeah, I'm just thinking of a book I read from Bobby Kamari, who I think's been in Woman Alive, because I think she's a single woman. And I think she just does a really good job of writing about what it is that we are sexual beings, even if we're not married. And yeah, I just recommend that book, I think.
Great.
I can't remember the name, sorry.
Bobby actually we published for about a year snippets from that book. And you can find out more about her writing and her work actually if you go to womanalive.co.uk and search for Bobby Kumari, and that's Bobbi, and the Kumari is Kumari. So thank you for referencing that, Kate, because that is a really important thing to mention and book. So to you both, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We've covered a lot today. I'm not a parent yet, and yet it's given me a lot of thought around if I were to become one, how I would talk to my children about sex and sex education. So thank you both for joining me on the podcast today. Both welcome back anytime. Love having friends of the podcast back. Kate, you already are one. Emma, you will now be when you come back on again. Thank you for listening. I'll be back with more amazing guests next week.
For more inspiring conversations, articles and opinions, head to womanalive.co.uk. Woman Alive. Real women, real lives, real faith.
You can read today's article and the relationships dilemma at womanalive.co.uk. If there's a conversation you want to hear on the podcast, or if you have a question about sex and relationships, you can email me at womanalive@premier.org.uk.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.